but by now I was flustered and my neck was drenched. It wasn't a great start to what could be a significant evening in my career. The driver got as close as he could to the entrance. I think he dumped us out at a bus stop on the corner, and we got out. I opened up my umbrella, and we walked up to the security guards. Before we could explain things, they directed us towards the general admission line to get into the ballroom. "I'm supposed to walk the red carpet. I'm nominated," I informed them. "You?" one said. "Yeah. Really?" After a moment of hesitation, they pointed us towards the check-in tent across a rainy path full of puddles. We trekked through the weather to the tent and went up to the woman who appeared to be in charge. She said, "Hi there. The general admission entrance is that way." "I'm nominated," I said, starting to feel like an idiot. I don't like to sound arrogant or brag or say, "Do you know who I am?" But in this case, I had to say something or I'd never get into the room. She shot me the same look of disbelief as the security guards. They had to go through a binder that looked like a yearbook and search through the photos to try and find my face. Even after they found it, they still questioned me as if I were trying to fraudulently enter the red carpet. It was like there was no way possible I was meant to be there. I felt like Julia Roberts in Pretty Woman, but finally, they confirmed that I had the same huge forehead as the guy in their book. As soon as we hit the red carpet, we were blinded by a flash of lightning. Not real lightning. 100 camera flashes had gone off because Seth Rogen was in front of us, standing in front of the Step and Repeat wall with the American Comedy Awards logo on it. Seth negotiated that scene like a pro. He was smiling at ease and natural. Next, it was our turn. Lana said, "You go. I'll meet you at the end." "No way," I said. "You're coming with me." If you know anything about my wife, she goes with the flow. If I wanted her to try something, she was game. If I wanted to do something on my own, she's cool with that too. That night, I wanted her with me, so we walked together. As we began, the PR rep announced my name, which apparently was a cue for the photographers to clean their lenses. I waited for them to get done and told myself, they must really want clean, crisp photos of me. I walked along the red carpet, twisting and turning, with no flash going off, feeling a little conspicuous and uncomfortable. And then finally, a photographer called my name, "Sebastian, Sebastian, move aside. I want one of Lana by herself." "What, for his private collection?" I stepped aside and the lightning storm went off for my wife. This went on for the rest of the red carpet walk. People yelling at me to get the hell out of the way. I was a good sport, laughing along. We entered the ballroom and found our seats at a table for eight in the middle of the room. Once we were seated, I shook off my annoyance and remembered why we'd made the trip. It was exciting to be in the room. Chris Rock was there to present a Lifetime Achievement Award to Bill Cosby, pre-rape allegations. A quick glance around and I saw Kate McKinnon, Amy Poehler, tons of comedy all-stars. We settled in, and Lana and I had a cocktail. I was holding off because I want to be clear-headed for my award. As I continued to gawk around at other nominees, I realized something that made my heart sink. I said to Lana, "Nobody is here from my category except Maria Bamford." As the dinner was served and the show got started, I checked the program to see how many nominees from other categories had shown up. 9 people for the best concert comic, and only Jim Gaffigan is here, I said to Lana. I was making a study of this, hoping it didn't mean what I feared it did. As the awards were announced and people started going up to receive them, I got the feeling that their joyful surprise reactions were fake. Some of them went up to accept with props. Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg won for Best Comedy Director in Film, for this is the end. Seth said, "We first learned about the ACAs 4 days ago, and we came to receive the award in person because it's being televised and we literally were guaranteed to win." Rogan and Goldberg knew they were going to win. They all knew they were going to win. Maria Bamford, I noticed, looked very relaxed, not on edge of her seat at all about the upcoming category. So if someone told her who the winner was, and no one told me, that could only mean that she was going to take home the award. How the hell did she know? I had to assume the ACA told her manager to make sure she'd show up. If the winning managers knew, did the losers' managers know too? None of their losing nominees were there. They had to know they hadn't won. Why didn't my managers tell me? As I was putting the puzzle pieces together, I felt like Jim Carrey in The Truman Show. Everybody else knew what was going on. I was the only asshole who didn't. And I was hungry, too. I hadn't eaten food because I thought I might have to give a speech and didn't want roasted baby carrots stuck in my teeth. You know the self-control it takes for me to pass up dinner? Even a gross piece of rubber chicken? A fucking lot. What a putz I was sitting there. The joke was on me. I had handwritten the speech. I'd practiced it. When my category was announced, the camera zoomed in on me tight. That moment was funnier than anything else. I just figured out what was going on, and I had to pretend like I was still hoping. My people to thank card was poking out of my pocket. I had to wonder if the camera guy was in on it too, and the producers in the truck outside. Were they saying into the camera guy's earpiece, "Get a close-up on Sebastian. Holy shit, he wrote a speech. He doesn't even know he's going to lose. He actually thinks he's got a shot. Zoom in on the index card." The presenter announced Maria Bamford's win. I was thinking, whatever happens, clap and smile and act like you're happy for her. Even if I hadn't figured out I already lost, I would have felt the sting of disappointment. It wasn't a crushing blow. It would have been nice to win, but as always, I was just glad to be there. I applauded. I listened to her short speech thanking a list of people. My speech had an arc, a climax, a plot, main characters, and I finished with a denouement. It was so good. They would have given me an award next year for best acceptance speech. Now that I knew for absolutely sure I would not have to do or say anything, I started to let loose and began drinking. Bacardi and diets. The Hammerstein Ballroom staff might have been on the fix because they kept bringing me more drinks. Sometime between number 3 and 4, I got the hiccups. When Bill Cosby got his Lifetime Achievement Award, he gave the longest acceptance speech I have ever heard in my entire life. It was like your grandpa telling old war stories. It was so quiet in the room, I was trying to hold back the damn hiccups. But about every 32 seconds, one would come up, and there was nothing I could do to stop it. My wife was looking at me in disbelief. She knew that when I got the hiccups, they last for hours. We were seated right in camera view, so we couldn't get up and leave in the middle of Cosby's endless talk. I was desperate to make the hiccups stop, but I couldn't do anything about it. Cosby finally stopped talking, and a lot of comedians in the crowd went up on stage to join him in the celebration. Not me. I'm not good at the end of anything. Dancing, clapping, waving to the crowd, hugging people, or searching for someone to shake their hand. What were they going to talk about up there? I had no idea. Instead, Lana and I slipped out. When the show was over, Lana said, "What now?" "Take a wild guess. I'm starving. Let's go eat dinner." "Where?" "A week earlier, I tried to get us a reservation at Carbone on Thompson Street, the hardest restaurant to get into in NYC. The woman on the phone told me in what I call a nice mean voice that the place was completely booked for the next 4 calendar years. I looked at Lana in her gorgeous dress. I looked down at the buttons we put so much sweat into fastening on me. We had to salvage this night. I hiccuped again and I said, fuck it, we're going to Carbone. Lana said, even though we couldn't get... I don't care. Let's go. Growing up, I went out to dinner with my parents and grandparents as often as the World Cup, once every 4 years. We'd go to the same place every time, Giannotti's. It was the only time I ever saw my grandmother out of her salmon-colored nightgown. You knew it was a special night whenever my father did his mother's hair in the makeshift salon he had set up in the basement, followed by my mother and then my sister. My dad hated this. He had already worked 60 hours that week, and these three women were the most difficult clients he had. They didn't pay, and they tried to micromanage him. When they told him what to do, he would say, "Nobody told Michelangelo how to paint the Sistine Chapel. Now, Bafangu." At Giannotti's, we would start right in discussing what we were thinking of having. Then my dad announced what he was going to order, which signified that we could get anything on the menu equal to or less than what he chose. If you wanted a steak and he was thinking of pasta, too bad. There was always a next time in just 4 short years. God forbid you left anything on the plate. You would get a lecture from my father about wasting food and his money, while he polished off one unfinished plate after the next. He ate like a Viking, littering bones and shells all around him. Watching him, you might cringe, but you couldn't look away. The man could gnaw on a lamb chop while deboning a fish. Toward the end of the meal, an uncomfortable anticipation always came over the table because the kids were going to want dessert. Chocolate cake, key lime pie, cheesecake. However, my grandmother had invariably just made 17 different types of cookies. Gigiolini, cucciadari, biscotti, all that tasted the same. Dry. We ordered dessert at Giannotti's maybe once ever, and my grandmother was so insulted she sulked for a week. There was always a struggle between my grandfather and my father over the bill. My father would do everything he could to prevent my grandfather from seeing the total cost. If he did, he'd fly into a Sicilian rage, cursing in rapid fire in Italian. I would ask my father, what did he say? The answer was always, there are no words in English. I knew it had something to do with how my grandmother could have made a better meal for a fraction of the price that would have fed the whole neighborhood for 2 weeks. At Giannotti's, I was introduced to the Salvatore Maniscalco banking system. He would pull out of his pocket a worn envelope. It was covered with water damage and coffee stains and had possibly been passed down from out of my great-grandfather's pocket. I would ask, Dad, what is that? In a panel in the ceiling, he had several envelopes that were stuffed with cash. One was for going out. Others were marked landscapings, fix, and rainy days. To pay the restaurant tab, he would take bills out of the envelope, line them up perfectly with all the president's head facing in the same direction. Until the waiter came to take the money, Dad would count and recount it, and tapped the pile of bills like he was burping a little baby. During this whole time, you couldn't talk to him. He was just staring at the wall, thinking about how many perms and dye jobs he would have to do to replenish the envelope. My father is a 20% tipper across the board when we go anywhere. As a hairstylist, he earns his living off tips, so he's very mindful of others in the service industry. When he goes out with people, he gets nervous that when the bill is split, they won't tip as well as he does, and then he'll be guilty by association. Salvo's pro tips on tipping. 1. Cash is king. Always have a knot of cash to cover the cost of the meal and tip in cash. 2. Carry several bills in each denomination. Be prepared to pay the bill and the exact change so the waiter doesn't have to bring back anything. Round up to the nearest dollar amount. 3. Always hand the waiter the tip. You want your face to be associated with the cash. Do not just leave the tip on the table. If you walk out that door, someone else may pocket it. Lana and I took a taxi to the West Village and walked into Carbone without a reservation. I might have not won a Lucy, but I was determined to redeem myself by getting a table. I know there are hundreds of excellent restaurants in New York City, but it was a point of pride for me to get into this one. I had supreme faith that we would. It was the power of the tux. If you dressed up, you had a little bit more confidence. If we've been in jeans and t-shirts, forget it. But we were in black tie. Good black tie. We entered the dark restaurant with sexy low lighting and walked right up to the hostess stand. Why do hostesses always have an attitude as if you're interrupting them? They glare at you when you walk in like, oh, you think I'm actually going to take you to a table here? Who do you think you are? Even when you say, yes, I have a reservation, they question it, or they seem to hope they won't find your name on the list, or they act as if they get pleasure telling you to take off. If they make any negative grunts at all, I scan the list and find my own name upside down. You know how hard it is to read Maniscalco upside down? Most people can't even read it right side up. The Carbone hostess was a piece of work right off the bat, but I wasn't going to let her get to me. Not in the tux. The tux doesn't take bullshit. The tux won't be denied. I said, good evening, in my sweet friendly, I have a tear-soaked acceptance speech in my pocket voice. It was the voice of a guy you would want to pull a few strings for. I spoke quickly, though, because I had to fit it all in between hiccups. I tried to throw in a quick comedy bit, but it bombed. When people ask me who the toughest audience is, I tell them any girl in her 20s working as a hostess at a hot restaurant in New York. She fake smiled and said, how may I help you? Do you have anything for two? For tonight? For right now? She gave a little laugh that signified, I'm in control, and you're out of luck. But before she shot me down, I reached in my pocket to take out $100 bill. I said, we don't have a reservation, but we're starving. It's our only night in the city, and we heard we have to come here. It's impossible. Then I slipped the hunch into her hand and said, let me know if anything suddenly opens up. The bill was snatched out of my hand the way a hungry alligator snaps up prey and then softly sinks into the water. It disappeared so fast into her pocket, I thought for a second that I hadn't given it to her at all. 15 seconds later, a guy in a black suit escorted us to a table. It was the best table in the house, hugging the window and giving us an unobstructed view of Thompson Street. It was like the Copa scene from Goodfellas. I don't know if they brought a table up from the basement, but suddenly we were seated. I have been on the other side of a hunch slip, and it worked on me, too. At the Four Seasons, a guy gave me $100 to move somebody out of a specific table, secluded outside, so he could sit there. He put the bill in my hand and said, see what you could do. I marched right over to the table and told the woman, a large party is coming in and they had a reserve on this table. Would you mind moving? Next round's on me. They moved and I spent $30 on their drinks, but I walked away with $70 and it made my night. I would have done a lot more for less. $100 bill makes you move. There's something about it. You don't see it often. It's like an eclipse. It's the most you can give anybody in a single bill. In NYC, they get it. 100 has influence. It means something. You give one to the right person, boom, you're set. In L.A., with the exception of myself at the Windows Lounge, servers are clueless. They don't get it at all. My wife and I went to this restaurant called Felix, a hot spot in Venice. It's practically impossible to get in, but I called my agent, who is tapped into the food world, and he got us a reservation for Lana's birthday. We had a wine, a variety of pastas, some desserts. No bill, because my managers picked it up for us as a gift. I still gave the waiter a tip, though. He was going to get 20% regardless, but I gave him a crisp hunch and said, "Thanks for a great meal. Let me ask you, who's the guy we need to talk to next time if we want to come back?" In other words, this is not a tip. It's a payoff for a connection. He said, Oh, wow. No, thank you. Thank you. So next time you want to come in, you could call the reservation desk during the day, during the business hours. I said, No. Who's the guy? The guy I need to talk to in order for us to make sure we get in. Well, what a lot of people do is they come down here and they wait to see if anybody cancels their reservation. He was looking at me cross-eyed the whole time. With patience, I said, "Who's the guy?" Lana said, "Don't bother." So at Felix, I tried to pull the dice-style pro deal move to no avail. Back in New York at Carbone, I was in. When you tip 100, word travels faster than the speed of sound through the back of the restaurant, and we were inundated with service. The water guy showed off his pouring technique like a human Bellagio fountain. The bread guy was juggling loaves, carving out portraits into the cold butter. The sommelier was out within 7 seconds from wherever he goes when he isn't helping people pick out wine. Do they keep him in a closet where he could groom his nose with artisanal tweezers while wearing a tongue mask, giving his taste buds a facial? Usually it takes a sommelier a while to get out to the table, like he's tied up on an emergency phone call. Shit, that night, he was all over us. Once you tip $100 at the door, you can't just order soup and split it. We had to live up to the tip. And that meant appetizers, entrees, desserts. Lana tells me that we had a fantastic, unforgettable meal along with a fantastic bottle of wine. On top of the 4 cocktails I had, the wine put me way over the top. So I have no recollection up until the tiramisu, which jolted me awake like smelling salts. Meanwhile, my hiccups never went away. If anything, they'd only gotten worse. Back at the hotel room, and blissfully out of my excruciating tight pants, we tried a cure. Lana was Googling and reporting all these folk remedies. Drinking water while pinching your nose. Breathing into a white paper bag. Holding your breath while doing neck rolls. I did everything I possibly could to get rid of them. Nothing worked. So I came up with my own solution of doing a headstand on the bed. I put my head on the mattress and kicked my feet up in the air like a frog for 30 minutes. Apparently, when you go into shock and all of your blood in your body goes to your amygdala, the hiccups disappear. Pro tips for travel tipping. These days, I travel 28 weekends a year. I've got my travel tipping routine down. As a general rule of thumb, you grease good people who get you stuff. That's how it works in hospitality. I take care of you, you take care of me. I give a lot of tips. You do what you gotta do, but this is how I do it. A guy who's constantly on the road and in the air. The drivers. For the drivers to and from the airport, generally tip is included in the fare that you pay ahead of time by card. You don't have to tip on top of that. However, that gratuity might go in part to the company. So you might give them extra depending on the service. They've got to get out of the car to greet you. They got to put the bags in the back. It's a nice touch if the guy has a couple of bottles of water and snacks in the car. I had a guy once with a wet nap to wipe your hands and face. Maybe they provide mist or a phone charger. If I could tell they're going to go the extra mile, I give them an additional 10 or 20 on top of the automatic tip. Airport bag guys. When I hand my bags to the guys outside the terminal, I give them 10 bucks. When I first started out, it was like a buck a bag, but now I just peel a 10 right off the get-go. If I have a heavy bag, if I give them a 10, they don't charge me the extra 100 because my suitcase is over the limit. The $10 tip saves me 90. Flight attendants. I've never tipped a flight attendant. That would be weird. Hotel front guy, valet. When you arrive at the hotel, you're usually greeted by a doorman or a valet. What I do is give them 10 right out of the car, especially if I'm driving. For 10 bucks, he'll park it in the back of the lot. For 20 a day, he'll keep it up top, ready right when you walk out. Bellhops. Meanwhile, when you pull up, someone is taking your bags out of the car. But he's probably not a guy to bring them to your room. It's confusing. If I don't have a lot of heavy bags and it's just me, I give him a 10. When the bags arrive, if it's a different guy, I give him 10 too. Housekeeping. I leave housekeeping $5 per day and $5 per night if they have a turndown service. If I don't use a day of service, I leave 20 because they get paid per room, and if they miss a day because I had the do not disturb sign up, I want to make it up to them. Room service. An additional tip for room service is bullshit. I don't even like it when they add the tip to the bill. It's presumptuous. If the person is nice and engaged, I might leave a little, but it's not required. The doorman. The doorman hails me a cab, he gets $5. Concierge service. Now, if you call down to the concierge and ask them to bring a toothbrush and a toothpaste to your room, the guy who does bring it up to the room gets a 5. Could I go downstairs and buy my floss for less than 5? Yeah, but if someone does your shopping for you, you gotta tip them. The waiter. I start at 20%, but might go up to 25 or 30 if the service is great. You have to shit on my burger for me to give you less than 20%. If the waiter is a bad server and you don't tip him 20%, then he or she will say, see, I knew he wouldn't tip, regardless. I know what they're going through and they deserve the money. The hostess. To get a table, 100 will guarantee you one no matter where you are in the U.S. If not, get out of there. They suck. The hunch slip has never let me down. If you do it once, you're good for life at some places. I gave 100 at a wine place I go to. The host will now secure me a table anytime I show up. If you want to be treated well, give a nice tip. It's not so hard to understand. You don't have to drop 20s left and right. Just whatever you could do will be appreciated. Chapter 10. Coffee Date. I met Chris Mazzilli, co-owner of the Gotham Comedy Club, in 2009 at the Just for Laughs Comedy Festival in Montreal, Canada. At the time, I've never done his club. I just got introduced to him in the lobby of the Hilton Hotel by a comedian by the name of Steve Byrne. Steve said, hey, Chris, this is my friend Sebastian, a really good comedian. He should do your club. At this point in my career, I had to wonder how the hell everybody else had played New York City but me. How did everyone else know one another? This guy had never heard of me? I felt like I was behind. I wondered why I was always the guy pursuing instead of being chased. It had been the same when I was trying to meet girls. I always found out too late. I heard the girl I had a crush on in high school also liked me, but I didn't hear this news until I was in college. It was sort of like living in Europe and getting the new movies 2 years later. Nobody would ever say, hey, Sebastian, so-and-so likes you. My friend in high school, Tony Sakala, was the exact opposite. We would go out, and the woman would flock to him like flies on shit. This was only after he turned 18. Before then, he was heavy. But he went on a mission to get ripped. He lost 40 pounds and changed his name to Anthony. You can't just demand that people call you by your full name all of a sudden because you lose weight. You can't just add the letters back. I called him Tony my whole life, and now I had to recalibrate? So anyway, at a club, he would leave with one girl, plus 8 dates lined up for the week. If I was lucky, I would leave with one phone number on a napkin, praying it was real. I had to court the girls, try and charm them with my humor, open their car doors, and prove to them I was a decent guy. It was always a struggle. Bottom line, no girls or gigs ever fell in my lap. I was never the funny, charismatic guy when meeting girls. Never the life of the party. I always wanted to be, but I'm just realizing that I have always been reserved and insecure about this. I wanted people to seek me out. I felt like a buffoon if I was trying to sell myself in personal and professional relationships. But being open went against every ounce of Sicilian blood running through my veins. Sicilians are skeptical and always assume the worst, with good reason. Over centuries, the island was overtaken by the Greeks, the Germans, the Turks, the Normans, the Spanish. The people had to rely on each other for survival, and they got closed off and distrustful of anyone outside their family. Case in point, the Sicilian Colleone family. I know it seems like a contradiction to be a stand-up comedian who hates to call attention to himself, but that was how I felt. I was like a conch deep in his shell that someone would have to find and pry out. Over time, I realized that, Sicilian or not, I had to put myself out there and be open for the right opportunity to walk in. Or else I'd never get to New York City or move up to the next level in my career. Doing stand-up gave me confidence to be more social, but I had to push it farther and step into the spotlight. So back at the Montreal Hilton, Steve fixed me up with Chris. Chris and I talked for a bit, and I guess he got to see my act during the festival. Shortly after that, I got a date at Gotham. On my first gig there, I just couldn't feel comfortable without supplying a thank you gift for the staff. I had been there on the other side, and I wanted good energy in the room. A little goes a long way with people in the service industry. They work on tips to feel appreciated. Second to a tip is a delicious chocolate cupcake in their mouth. A weekend act comes into a town to do a gig, and he leaves behind his reputation with the staff. They will talk about how nice or terrible he was, how he drank, how he tipped, how friendly he was. This chatter spreads wildly through the saloon doors of the kitchen to the back hallways of the club, into other clubs and other kitchens, and all the way into the management offices. I knew this, having been there on the other side. So I walked into Gotham with a huge box of Baked by Melissa cupcakes. I passed them out to everyone who worked there, from the bartenders to the waitstaff to the busboys. I wanted everybody to be happy, and honestly, it was the least I could do. My mother taught me never to show up to anyone's house empty-handed, and this was just an extension of that. The stakes were high when I arrived at what I considered to be one of the hottest rooms in Manhattan. All the heavyweights performed there, and often showed up unannounced to do a celebrity pop-in, making it a real comedy lover's paradise. On any given night, the audience of 350 might be treated to an impromptu hour with Jerry Seinfeld, Dave Chappelle, Louis Black, or Chris Rock. Apparently, the cupcakes worked. I had a great weekend at Gotham, killing it and befriending everyone there. Chris and I became fast friends that weekend, too. He let me know in a very subtle, classy way that he believed in me and he could foresee a big future for me. By the end of the week, he said, "I really like what you do. I'm not trying to poach you at all, but if you're ever unhappy with your current management and representation, we're here." It was a refreshing change. Someone was noticing and pursuing me. I needed someone who believed in me like this, and for the first time, I felt like someone out there was taking notice. I was 12 years into the game. My career was on the upswing, and the next step was to assemble the right team around me. Chris and his brother Steve Mazzilli were part of LEG, a talent management company. They could connect me in the comedy world and introduce me to people. They also knew the casino business and would open doors for me to do stand-up in some big venues. Back in L.A., I had dinner with the head of LEG, Judy Marmel. While courting me to sign on, she took me to a Hawaiian-themed restaurant across the street from her office. This restaurant was not one you'd consider to be high-end, especially given the situation. We still joke about how absent-minded she was to take me there for our first dinner. The restaurant wasn't good, but I knew Judy would be the one to take me to the next level. So managers, when courting comedians, don't take them to cheap Hawaiian. Long story short, I ended up signing with LEG, working with Chris Mazzilli, his brother Steve, and the LA division. I was assigned a day-to-day point person. Most of the junior guys were cape-grabbing in the game for free ping pong and swag at different events. I demanded if I was going to stay on with LEG, I wanted to work directly with Judy, the queen bee, a woman who would buzz into our meetings and make all the worker bees sit up and try to impress her. I began to call her Buzz Buzz. As I came to learn quickly, she is a tried and true ball buster who earned a reputation over the last 30 years of being one of the hardest working managers in the business. Judy has quarterbacked my career to where it is today. She orchestrated all the different aspects of it and is always forward thinking. It's all about momentum, with one thing building upon another. She capitalizes on the moment and turns one good thing into other opportunities. Judy is a no-nonsense woman who really knows the business inside and out. She's exceptional at what she does, and I just want to pay homage to her and say thanks. I'm a loyal guy, and I like to stay with the people who have worked hard for me for all these years, including my team at United Talent Agency. I've been with them for 10 years now, and they have given me many opportunities to do movies and TV, as well as touring. With all these pros in my corner, I got to do more improvs all around the country, as LEG owns the improv chains. LEG also produced my second special, What's Wrong With People, which really put me on the map. And none of it would have happened if it weren't for that chance meeting in a hotel lobby in Montreal. Chris and Jerry Seinfeld have been friends for many years. Chris had mentioned to me on multiple occasions that he knew Jerry would be a huge fan of mine and that it was just a matter of time before he could fix us up. When I finally did meet Jerry in early 2015, I was headlining at Gotham. He stopped in to do a set right before I went on. I'd been told he was coming in, and I was excited that we were finally going to meet. I'd introduced myself right before he went on stage. Even though I was so excited to meet him, we were both so anti-small talk. We just said hi and bye, and maybe I'll see you later. I mean, what was I supposed to say? Hey, man, I am so funny. You should watch me and laugh. I've been a Seinfeld fan since I was 13. Watching Jerry do stand-up about New York taxi drivers at Dangerfields, Ronnie's Comedy Club on East 61st Street, I clearly remember seeing him on a Jerry Lewis telethon, doing a bit about taking a shower in somebody else's bathroom and noticing a little hair stuck on a wall. I don't like showering in other people's showers. There's always a problem with the temperature adjustment. And there's always a little hair stuck on the wall. You want to get rid of it, but you don't want to touch it. I don't know how it got up that high in the first place. Maybe it's got a life of its own. I'd seen hair on shower walls, but I never thought of it the way he did. He's a genius at noticing these little absurdities in life, pointing them out, and seeing them from his own perspective. I respond to that style of observational humor. Jerry and I are on the same wavelength in that way. Relatable comedy about familiar, simple things. Plus, his stand-up is precise and lean, no fat on his jokes. He knows that every word means something in comedy. You're not up there to mumble with nothing phrases and sounds. I hate it when a comedian stalls with a or like. I pare down my stand-up to as few words as possible to get the point across, and I learned that from Jerry. Like everyone else I knew growing up, I counted the days between episodes of Seinfeld. The wackiness, the absurdity, A lot of things going on at once, multiple storylines culminating at the end of a 23-minute sitcom. As a kid, I assumed every person in New York was crazy or hilarious or both. And I totally related it to my own wild, hilarious family. Like Jerry's comedy, mine is based on my life and observation, but it rings true for just about anyone. You don't have to be Italian or from Chicago to get it. I meet fans from all over the world who tell me, "You're talking about my family," even though obviously I'm not. The goal is to transport the audience into your reality regardless of where they come from. To tap into the familiar, the things we all know and feel, and describe it in a funny way. The audience that night at Gotham had come to see me, but they were also huge Seinfeld fans. The MC announced that there was a special guest, and when Jerry walked out, the place went nuts. They were screaming, standing, and cheering. They couldn't believe that Jerry Seinfeld was right there in front of them in this intimate club. The celebrity pop-in is not unique to Gotham. It's a regular occurrence at the Comedy Store and other popular clubs. Usually, if a big name walks in and wants to do time, he or she goes up right away and the regular lineup gets bumped. It sucked as an up-and-coming comedian thinking you'd finally get a prime set time only to get bumped and wind up performing at 2 a.m. after everyone goes home. But that's just the way it works in the comedy world. As a young comedian, you learn to roll with the schedule changes. But even a bigger issue is how you're going to follow a big name with great new material. Anyone would be nervous and ask themselves, how do I segue into my act after the audience is basking in the afterglow of an unexpected encounter with Chris Rock? So the whole time Jerry was performing at Gotham, I'm backstage thinking, how do I bridge the gap between his act and mine? You can't follow up Jerry Seinfeld with, "So where are you from?" or "What do you do for a living?" I just flew in from Cleveland, and boy, do I have a crink in my neck. It was wintertime, and Jerry had a scarf on. It was tied intricately, very stylish, very New York, and he kept it on for the first 3 minutes of his set. So when I got on stage, I said, "Give it up for Jerry Seinfeld. You know how confident you gotta be to wear a scarf 3 minutes into your set?" And then I did a physical act of tying the scarf and used the microphone cord as a prop. It just kind of loosened up the crowd, reminded them what my comedy is about, and then boom, I went right into my act. Usually, after a pop-in, Jerry would leave the club right away, according to Chris. He rarely watched 5 minutes of anyone. But Jerry stayed for the first 45 minutes of my set. Lana was there that night and could see him laughing. I was on cloud nine knowing that Jerry had enjoyed my set. The next night, I was told that Jerry was sending his wife, Jessica, with a group of friends to see me. This made me nervous. It was one thing to perform for Jerry Seinfeld, and another to do it for his wife. I know in my own marriage, if Lana doesn't approve of something, it could send me into a complete spiral. My wife could get into my head like she's the captain of my ship, unconsciously steering my thoughts. If her opinion of something is bad, my thoughts can turn stormy and throw off the whole course of my life without even knowing it. So I thought I had to make Jessica Seinfeld laugh to confirm Jerry's opinion of my comedy. It went well. I was invited to meet Jessica and her friends after the show. At some point, she put me on the phone with Jerry, and we had a nice chat. It occurred to me to ask Jessica for Jerry's number, but I would never do that. It's not my style. I'm the cat. I let people come to me. I let him dictate the connection. The last thing I would ever want to do is overstep my bounds or make assumptions. From afar, Jerry seemed like the kind of guy who didn't want to get to know anyone and didn't need or want any new friends. I could relate. It takes a cat to know another cat, and I could see his whiskers from a mile away. But as I got to know him, I was surprised at how generous and kind Jerry is. He truly loves what he does, and when he believes in something, he gives his whole heart to it. The next time I ran into him, it was at Gotham again. I remember talking to him about the business of comedy and keeping the act fresh and how to keep people coming back. He told me the main thing is to do your best material, regardless of whether it's new or old. The job is to make people laugh. Take note, Dad, and now get off my back about new material. As we exited the club, Jerry said, "Hey, do I have your number?" I said, "No, but here it is. Just don't abuse it," I said. He then got into his car, which was parked right in front of the club on the street in New York City. This is when it occurred to me that this guy has it all figured out. There had been a street cone holding his spot prior to his arrival. I thought, does the club have a cone guy? How do they determine who's in charge of the cone? Does a panic ensue when Jerry arrives? Is there a waiter being yelled at? "Drop the buffalo wings! Forget about the pigs in the blanket! Go get the cone! He's here!" This incident alone piqued my interest. It was a small window into Jerry's life. There's an intriguing quality about him. I was not only ecstatic that Jerry Seinfeld and I would possibly be exchanging Happy Hanukkahs and Merry Christmases, but I was also curious about how a man of his stature navigates his way through life. When you're a fan of someone who is way up there and now you have each other's number, it's strange. How do you use it? Jerry's age was somewhere between mine and my father's, so I had no idea how savvy he was with texting. If I send my father a text, I'm lucky to hear back at all. If I do, it's often indecipherable and sent long after I forgot about the initial text. Here's an example of a recent text exchange between us. "Dad, 1991. Me. What is 1991? Him. When I sold Luigi and Salvo, the salon he owned with his brother. Me. I asked you that 2 months ago. I've seen you 3 times since then, and Mom already answered. Him. 1991. Me. Okay. Thanks." With my mom, on the other hand, as soon as I send her a text, a reply bubble appears immediately, as if she was sitting around waiting on the text. I'm sure she was. If she texts me a question and I don't respond within 60 seconds, I'll get a follow-up message saying, "Hello." By the time I see the first text, she sent a string of hellos all lined up in unison. If Facebook needed a news anchor, it could be Roseanne Maniscalco. She might call me to say, "Did you see the Marinos kid is having another baby? You know the Marinos." I would say, "No, Ma, I have no idea who that is." "Oh, well, anyway, their niece Mary got a new car, a Kia, and it looks nice. What do you think of that car?" And then we're talking about the purchasing decisions of some person I don't know or care about for an hour and a half. Mom's Facebook ads are mostly medical equipment and medication because she has looked up so many illnesses while trying to self-diagnose. She goes so deep on Facebook, she has carpal tunnel in her pointer finger solely from pressing the "show more" button. So I had no idea what to expect about Jerry's phone style. Nowadays, it's a little too aggressive to pick up the phone and call somebody. But since we exchanged numbers, I felt I should just text a short message like, "Hey man, so great talking to you. Let's grab a bite the next time I'm in New York." And that would be that. I didn't hear from him for a few months, and then when I did, it wasn't direct. His production company contacted my agent with excellent news. Jerry wanted me to appear on Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee, his hit web series. This was huge. It was a Johnny Carson moment to me. When I was growing up, I would watch Johnny Carson, and I always loved it when he invited comics to sit on the couch and talk to him after they finished their sets. It was like being anointed by the king, the ultimate seal of approval with the whole world watching. From that moment on, your life would never be the same. In this day and age, there are so many platforms to be seen on TV. Cable, Netflix, YouTube, Instagram, a dozen talk shows. There's no one show that everyone watches like they did with Carson's Tonight Show. But for comedians, there is a show that gives you a sense of validation. And I've made it kind of feeling, and that's Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee. he only invites comedians he genuinely enjoys talking to, whom he'd want to hang out with in real life. And now it was my turn. I was getting the Carson Couch invite from Seinfeld. The Comedians in Cars concept is like a talk show, except instead of a desk and a couch, the host and the guests are in a car. The ride Jerry chose for our show was an orange 1969 Camaro Z28, the original Guido muscle car. He said he could see me driving around in it in high school. My real high school car was a 1984 Toyota Celica, shit brown, with a brown interior and roll-down windows that doubled as a forearm exerciser. The only thing that had power in the car was the engine, a robust four-cylinder that went from 0 to 60 in 2 days. Jerry picked me up at a house in L.A. It wasn't my own house, although I opened the door like I owned the place. It belonged to a friend of the producer's. My home in Hollywood was too far from where we were going in Santa Monica. We greeted each other, shook hands, and I realized we were dressed like identical twins in white shirts, navy blazers, and jeans. There were subtle differences. My jeans were skinny and his were sneaker cut. My shirt was a designer tee and his was a button-down. Jerry wore his blue and orange Mets Nikes. I wore boots. But standing side by side, it's like we called each other to wear matchy-matchy outfits. Jerry commented on my cologne. He said he didn't wear any. I was taught how to put on cologne by my grandfather. The technique was passed down from generation to generation in the Maniscalco family. And it goes as follows. A spritz on each wrist, two in the air, and then a walk through the mist. On the lawn, I showed Jerry how to do it, and he cracked up. I like how the joke played, and I later included that footage in the video I use before I come on stage at stand-up shows. Hey, if you had 5 seconds of video of yourself making Seinfeld laugh, you'd show it every chance you got, too. The first 5 minutes of the filming were almost surreal. On the show, it looks like we're just riding around Los Angeles, him driving, me grinning like a chimpanzee in the passenger seat, with a dash cam and multiple GoPros throughout the car. A gorilla-type production. But in reality, we had a police escort on a motorcycle and a production team in two vans, with three cameramen, a boom guy, and producers riding alongside and behind. Seeing the scope of what it took to make this show floored me. Jerry's only direction was the same one that I've heard since my earliest days in comedy. Just be yourself. He told me to be comfortable and pretend like the 89 people buzzing around us weren't there. I remember him saying, seems a little chaotic in the beginning, but I'd get used to it. It took 20 minutes before I felt like I could have a normal conversation. I'm so sensitive to energy. It was hard for me to be natural with all these people hovering. How to ignore the cameras? How can I be myself in front of 89 strangers? I could perform in front of strangers, but the only time I'm completely myself is when I'm with my wife. I'm a different version of myself depending on who I'm with. So I just had to find the one that would shine the best in this scenario. It's common practice for hosts on late-night TV to predetermine what you're going to talk about. The host comes in with a stack of questions and discussion topics that have been worked out ahead of time. A good host makes it seem off the cuff, but it's all arranged so that the comedian can do his or her act within the pretense of a spontaneous conversation. Before Jerry and I got in the car, he said, I want to set you up for that joke about taking your shoes off at somebody's house. I'll just weave it into a question that leads to that. He teed me up by talking about how I'm an obsessive groomer, how I like to polish myself up to a brilliant sheen. And we got to talking about the slob culture, and I ran with it. The airport's a prime example. People put on pajamas to fly. The way I grew up, when you see the world, the world sees you. When did it become appropriate to wear flip-flops to a nice steak dinner? I got to sit there eating a T-bone looking at some guy's hoof going, put a shoe on, gay. That dovetailed perfectly into, we went over for a dinner party last week at some guy's house, and as soon as I walk in, there's like 25 pairs of shoes sitting by the doorway. Guy says, this is a shoe-free environment. So I'm walking around his house with my socks on, meeting people with their socks on. How could you have a conversation with another man looking at their gold toes? I can't do it. He said, meanwhile, they got a dog dragging his ass around. I asked about his social life and how his wife has opened him up more. She has, because she's a normal person, he said. Just a human being. I have none of that. I told him, my wife wants me to smile more. She thinks I have a mean resting face. If I'm not smiling or talking, it looks like I could murder your entire family. Jerry claimed his wife never saw his true personality. My real person personality is nothing but judgment and hostility. You can't bring that home?
No.
I try and be friendly, I said. Doesn't work. Maybe it's the murderer face. The entire drive was like that, a volley back and forth of one or two liners, light and easy. I had no idea where we were going until he just pulled up into a parking lot of Intelligentsia, an extravagant coffee place where the coffee beans are raised like Kobe beef cows. They go to Guatemala and personally massage each bean for months. It's one of these hipster places where the barista has handlebar mustache and all the customers are on their laptops. If the Wi-Fi went down, the people would flee faster than if the health department condemned it. Modern-day coffee houses cannot exist without Wi-Fi and vice versa. They have a totally codependent relationship. We walked in with the production team, three cameras, a boom mic, and a lot of commotion. Not to mention a living icon of comedy. A guy who had the most successful show in the history of television. But the customers didn't even peel their eyes away from their Throwback Thursday posts. I was checking for people's reaction to Jerry. They didn't care. The president could have skipped in holding hands with Vladimir Putin, and they would have kept staring at their computer screens. It was eerily quiet, too, like one of my sets in the early days. It was not at all what I expected from being in public with Jerry. No commotion, no nothing. A couple of people sneaked peeks, but no one lost their shorts or anything remotely approaching gawkery. In L.A., a celebrity sighting is like seeing a McDonald's on a corner. If it was Cincinnati, they would have shut down the streets and bring out the riot cops. But this was a full-blown production, and people literally didn't bat an eye. I was stunned. Jerry took in this strange environment, too, and said, the world has turned into the monkey cage, darting eyes and a little fear. Funny, creepy, and so true. Only the waiter wasn't too cool for school. He was shy or nervous, rattling the porcelain cups and shaking a bit. Jerry engaged with him to calm him down, asking him what he wanted to do with his life, where he saw himself in 20 years. While they talked, I caught my breath before we picked up the conversation again. We'd gone through all the pre-planned stuff, and our talk became more organic. Exterminators, growing up Sicilian, the comedy world. He asked if I weren't doing comedy, what were my other career options? I said I would be in the hospitality business, although I had a problem with people. After coffee, we walked around in Venice and popped into a hat store. We spent 20 minutes goofing around, trying on fedoras and cowboy hats. Cue the rom-com shopping montage soundtrack. For the record, I'm not a hat person. My head's too large. When I wear a hat, it looks like a bottle cap on a watermelon. I was sure that our day would end there, but Jerry took me to the Tasting Kitchen, an Italian restaurant. It was closed, except for us. We sat down, and Jerry looked across the table at me and said, I've never taken anybody on this show for a glass of wine, but I think it's appropriate, you being Italian. You loving wine, I love wine. Let's go get some wine. I played it cool, but Now we were speaking my language. It is almost impossible for me to turn down a glass of good wine. Talk about being myself. Throw me a glass of Cabernet or a Tuscan wine, and there I am, in my element. Out came the Italian wine, olive.